have with us live in the studios, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good to have you back, Maria.
Thank you.
Yeah, we wanted to introduce our brand new commentator that will be coming to the show. Hopefully, he'll regularly now. And
I haven't been gone that long.
All right. Well, certain things, in fact, nothing has really changed here in the greater city of Seattle since you left, for better or for worse. Starting out with local, as we always do, and the Seattle Police Department.
Yeah, this week the Seattle Police Department's court-appointed monitor, Merrick Bob, issued his first status report this week. And he said that the SPD is working towards reforms, but it still has a really long way to go.
A really long way.
Really of interest in his report was his portrayal of the command ranks as being divided between those who are beginning to support reform and those who are still digging in their heels and resisting the very existence of an agreement between the City of Seattle and the Department of Justice. And I just want to quote him. He wrote, quote, infighting up and down the command staff level has been a concern, end quote. And as if on cue, someone inside the SPD released a copy of a video that Interim Chief Pugel made back in 1986. In the mid-80s.
With some of his friends.
Yeah, along with the help of some of SPD's finest that satirizes homeless people in a particularly gross and insensitive way.
Yeah, for people who haven't seen it, and I'll spare you the grief, it's a parody music video, the old 50s song Under the Boardwalk called Under the Viaduct, and you know the general idea is cops rousting homeless people. Ha ha ha! Isn't that funny? Aren't they disgusting?
Yeah.
It's actually, as offensive humor goes, pretty creative and pretty well done. But the interesting part isn't that cops have twisted offensive senses of humor, because anybody who's spent time around law enforcement knows that they get really cynical really fast, and this is what happens. And the video was made 27 years ago, so it's not necessarily, although in many ways it probably is, but it's not necessarily a reflection on SPD today. But why was it released now?
Yeah, it could have been released at any time in its 27-year history and would have done some pretty bad damage to the reputation of the Seattle Police Department, and in particular would have had caused people to question their promotion policy, since Pugel has been promoted through the ranks year after year after year. However, it came out now, and it really sort of supports what Bob said about infighting within the SPD command staff, because Pugel has been somewhat reform-minded, unlike a number of the higher-ups at SPD. And I think more importantly, this whole brouhaha over the video sort of masks and overshadows some of Merrick Bob's other points.
By the way, one other piece on the video before we move off it, the copies of it were supposed to be destroyed, because when the video was actually made, higher-ups looked at it and says, no, this is inappropriate, let's get rid of it. Somebody hung on to it for precisely this purpose.
Well, they kept a copy in the SPD archive. And so somebody within the SPD who had access to the archive leaked it to the media. So, yeah, it really does support what Bob said. There's infighting, and someone's trying to undermine the new interim chief. Now, in Merrick Bob's report, he made a very serious point about issues regarding his access to the Firearms Review Board. Now, the Firearms Review Board has control over reviewing and disciplining officers who have engaged in shootings and the discharge of their firearms. And they've never really seriously disciplined any officer. And in his report, Merrick Bob intimates that a quote-unquote presiding SPD executive has clamped down on open debate within the Firearms Review Board.
And that
he may also be guilty of helping to cover up for some officers who have been involved in shootings. Now, I want to point out that the head of the Firearms Review Board is Deputy Chief Clark Kimmerer, who's been competing with Pugel to be named new police chief of Seattle.
The permanent chief, Kimmerer, again, is another one who's been promoted over and over again throughout the years. And in this case, you know, it's not – Bob actually went a little farther than that and said also that he believed that there had been some coercion of internal testimony during
witnesses,
the negotiations. or redundant investigations of firearm discharge incidents. So, you know, clearly the review board not only isn't reviewing a lot of these discharge incidents, which include shooting of suspects, shooting of civilians, and so forth.
Yeah, they're covering up.
Yeah, they're covering up and making sure. And the other thing Bob mentioned also, he criticized, he said a lot of the resistance is coming from in and around the police union and specified that by name.
Yes, he did. Yeah, and it's interesting too, you know, here the city is starting up new negotiations for a contract with the police union, which had been put on hold because of the whole Department of Justice investigation and the settlement agreement and all the stuff that's come out of that. Now they're starting to negotiate over a new contract, and the city's saying, well, you know, maybe we ought to change our relationship to the police union. We can start by not paying a salary, a six-figure salary, to the head of the union. Let the union pay that wage.
Which I was astonished when I found out that the city actually paid
yeah.
the
Yeah, you don't see that union. In private industry. You don't see that with any other public union. Yeah. It's the only union in the city where they pay the wage.
It's not like the head of AFSCME's local, you know.
No.
Gets that.
No.
And you know, this is there's a history and a context to this also, which is that community activists have been literally for decades, but especially in the last 10-15 years, really pushing for civilian review of SPD and for some of the accountability reforms that have now been forced on Seattle by the federal government and the Department of Justice.
Yeah.
And it's not just that the police union has managed to hold up and forestall a lot of those. It's that the city has not, in its contract negotiations, ever seriously pushed the issue. And it's going to be two things. Number one, it's going to be very interesting to see if the city under McGinn, who has been a pretty shameless apologist for SPD throughout his tenure, is going to raise any of these issues. And number two, for the other candidates for mayor who are going to be running for this year's election, whether they're going to specifically during the process of contract negotiations say, you know, under my administration, we will take a much tougher line with the police guild.
Yeah, well, Harrell is the head of the public safety committee who takes a lead typically in negotiating.
City council, yeah.
Yeah. On city council, which typically takes a lead in negotiating the contract, and he's also going to be up for he's a mayoral candidate, so we'll see if he takes a harder line.
Yeah, and he and McGinn are very much at loggerheads on this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on to transit communities.
Yeah, the city council approved an amendment to the city's comprehensive plan, and the comprehensive plan governs what developers can do in the city of Seattle. The amendment defines a new type of zone for zoning purposes called transit communities. And
they announced this about 2 months ago.
Yeah, and you can tell that Richard Conlon drafted this amendment. They just passed it this week, the full council. And he drafted the amendment. And the amendment defines the transit communities in a really vague, touchy-feely way as, quote, complete, compact, connected places that offer a sustainable lifestyle, generally within a 10-minute walk of reliable, frequent transit service. So, a little map accompanied the amendment when it was passed. And I looked at the map, and the map shows that some of these proposed transit communities are already commercial districts like the University District or Northwest Market Street through Ballard, places that are heavily commercial along Aurora Avenue North, places like that. But it also defined some areas as potential transit communities that don't have frequent enough bus service. And that includes areas along Finney Avenue North, areas that are northeast of Northgate, for example, or areas that are north of Northwest Market Street in Ballard,
and
where bus service is just not frequent enough.
And areas that, under their own neighborhood plans, which have been approved by the city, don't call for the kind of concentration of businesses and residencies that are envisioned in community
in
zones.
This is also
an end run in many ways around neighborhood planning.
Yeah, it is. And you have to ask, is this really meant to be a green measure, as Conlon likes to say, or is it really just another gift to developers? And my guess is, yes, it is a gift to developers, because the transit doesn't exist to support a lot of these areas, and Metro's already proposing doing additional 17% service cuts across the board.
Yeah. And bear in mind that Richard Conlon has a history of using green rhetoric to mask very developer-friendly legislation.
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of developers, finally decided on the fees this week for SLU, South Lake Union.
Yeah, the council finally approved the fees and finally settled on a number. We knew the number was not going to be high. Just to put this in context, I'm sure you've talked about this in the past, Job, but these fees are meant to encourage developers to build some amount of affordable housing.
That's not actually how it works. They're in lieu of the developers building it. What it is that the fees...
They're called incentive fees. And yeah, the way incentive fees work is they're supposed to encourage developers to build. And if they're not going to build affordable housing, then they pay a fee.
Yeah.
And the fee should be high enough to actually be an incentive. So Nick Licata said, let's make the fees high enough so that they encourage developers to build the actual housing. So let's set the fees at $96. On the other end of the spectrum, Mayor McGinn said, oh no, let's just make them a kind of a nominal fee of $15 per square foot.
The way the city has set up the legislation grossly undervalues the cost of actually building affordable housing. And so
they settled on $21.68 per square foot.
What developers have done is they will never build the housing themselves.
Yes.
They will always pay the fee because it's so much cheaper. It's really a legislative gift to developers.
Yes.
And it has not even kept up with inflation since the incentive zoning program was passed. And so you had four different proposals, which ranged from the lowest, which mirrored Mayor McGinn's $15 a net square foot fee, all the way up to Licata's, which is originally $120 or $96, depending on how you measure it, whether it's gross or net. Licata's was never seriously considered. The other three were in the lower range. And it was very interesting that in the public hearing last month, there was a lot of community support for Licata's proposal and the higher fee. Not one council member other than Licata spoke for it at any point. So that was dismissed pretty much out of hand. And this is very much how Seattle City Council has historically worked. You wind up with four proposals, three of which had some level of support. And everybody goes behind closed doors and hashes out their compromise under tremendous pressure from the developer lobby. And what we came out with was a variation on Mike O'Brien's proposal at $21 per net square foot and a unanimous council vote. That is how the legislative process in Seattle works. Most of the major decisions were made behind closed doors with zero transparency. And guess what? The developers won.
Yeah, and it doesn't even meet the city council's goals, the city's goals for affordable housing. This $21.68 per square foot, not on all square feet, mind you, but only on the floors of a building that are going to be levied on the floors of a building that are going to be above the actual height limits.
That's why per net square foot.
Yeah, per net square foot. And this new fee is only going to bring in enough money to build about 700 affordable units for the city to hire, not to get those developers to build it, but for the city to hire nonprofit groups to come in and build it if they can find affordable land in South Lake Union, which is not going to happen. But they could potentially build about 700 new affordable apartments in the next 18 years. That's what, 39 units per year? The city's goal is 3,200 units in South Lake Union in that time frame. So this doesn't even get close to it.
And yeah, it's about a 1-to-80 ratio. And this is also the debate in which Richard Conway made his, once again, the developer's best friend, made his famous comment, I believe it was in March I don't understand why the city is trying to encourage affordable housing in South Lake Union anyway. We should put all the poor people down in the south end of the Rainier Valley.
Yeah. I mean, this is the kind of classism and, in a sense, racism, you can argue as well. Of our mainstream city council members.
All right, moving on, Coltrane's development this week.
Yeah, some good news, because we like to throw that in every now and then. Mayor McGinn, as part of the various Earth Day ceremonies that the city had, announced a new coalition called the Leadership Alliance Against Coal that brings together a number of city governments and tribal governments to stop coal trains. The various proposals in the Pacific Northwest, I believe there's five major ports that are involved in Oregon and Washington, where coal exported, very dirty coal is being proposed to be exported from new operations in Montana and Wyoming and then exported to China. And so you now have Seattle as well as Marysville, Shoreline, Spokane, Sumner, Edmonds, Bainbridge Island, and the tribes of the Lummi, Spokane, Swinomish, and Tulalips, coming together, and hopefully other cities, in the future will join this, and particularly cities in the Puget Sound area, I would hope, to try and stop the coal trains. This is really the first time that the city of Seattle has come out specifically against these proposals. They've certainly started both economic and environmental studies to review what impact the coal train proposals would have on the city. But this is the first time that they've stated their opposition. And even though it's pretty nakedly political and comes in the context of a mayoral and city council election this fall, still a very, very good sign, and also a sign that the very well-organized environmental opposition to these proposals is having an impact, and that impact is now filtering up to local elected officials.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, bouncing over to Eastern Washington and a proposed drone testing range.
Yes, the University of Washington, Washington State University, and the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, plus a bunch of local politicians, are lining up to submit a proposal to the Federal Aviation Administration, that's the FAA, to win approval of a new facility to research and test unmanned aerial drones for domestic use. Now, this is part of the FAA's national drive to set up 6 sites across the United States for this in order to study integrating unmanned drones into the nation's air traffic system. Of course, local politicians are saying we should get it one here in Washington State because it's going to bring thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in investment in this new industry. And that, you know, Washington State's a perfect site for it because we've hosted Boeing for so many years.
And it's going away.
Oh, yes. And that Boeing is starting to move operations elsewhere. So we should get in on this new industry. Well, the FAA has said, look, we're only going to, if we give you one of these sites, it's only going to be one of the 6 sites. You can't have more than that. And the facility, if we win one, is only going to employ less than 24 people. That's what the FAA has actually said, the FAA is not going to provide any money for this. The feds are not putting up any money for any of these facilities. The local taxpayers are going to have to pay to construct and fund the operations of any kind of drone testing facility until it starts to make money on its own. And local politicians are hoping that once you build it, that private companies will come and use it and pay the fees to use the testing facility, because of course private companies can't build their own testing facility because the FAA won't allow it. The FAA has to approve whatever facilities are used for the testing of unmanned drones. However, there are the main providers of unmanned aerial drones to the U.S. military are big military contractors like Boeing, for example, which owns In Situ as one of its subsidiaries. In Situ is one of the major suppliers of unmanned aerial drones to the U.S. military. Those guys are never going to use a public facility for testing unmanned aerial drones. They have a head start. They're already using, under the military contracts, they don't have to meet the FAA's requirements under these military contracts. So they're already using Boeing's facilities to test unmanned aerial drones, and they already have about a decade's head start on any small startup private company that wants to get into producing drones. So the idea that a new facility for that, funded by public taxpayer money, is going to eventually make money for the state is laughable.
All right. Moving on to national, just under 10 minutes left, starting with the media coverage of the Boston Marathon.
Yeah, you know, now that terrorism's back on the news shows, the focus now is not so much on who or why or how it could have happened, but it's on what motivated the two Boston Marathon bombers to do what they've done. And I have to say that anybody who has to ask what the motives are has not been paying attention to U.S. foreign policy, because, you know, the U.S. has been waging a drone, as we just talked about, unmanned aerial drone warfare against much of the Middle East for the last several years.
I would say actually that either that or they've been paying a lot of attention to U.S. foreign policy because there's so many potential motives to choose from.
It's hard to tell what to choose from. Yeah, that's true. But it's interesting, too, that the politicians in Congress are using this now as an excuse to not pass immigration reform. And when you look at some of the stuff that's coming out now about how Tamerlan Tsarnaev was treated by the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security before he came up with the idea to attack the U.S., you have to ask yourself, really, what didn't the U.S. government do to kind of push this guy to actually become a terrorist?
And these folks were both legal immigrants.
Yeah, they were both legal immigrants. The FBI, at the prompting of the Russian government, which, as we know, doesn't engage in human rights abuses, right?
Especially not against Chechens.
Right. Investigated Tamerlan Tsarnaev, sent FBI agents out to interview him and his relatives at least three times, and cleared him of any wrongdoing 2 years ago before the bombings. And then because of that FBI investigation, when he tried to apply for citizenship, his application was put on indefinite hold because he'd been investigated by the FBI. You know, not for any particular reason, but just because of that FBI investigation. And then,
which was again requested by the Russians, who have been abusing Chechens for many years,
for decades. And then, the Department of Homeland Security got in on the act, and they added him to their terrorism watch list. They added his name to their watch list. So when he tried to fly home to visit his family, he had to go through all kinds of harassment in order to get on an airplane. So you have to ask, you know, here's a man who's already feeling alienated and angry, and then suddenly the FBI's looking at him. He can't get citizenship. He can't get on an airplane without going through layers of further investigation. You know, what didn't the U.S. government do to turn this guy into a terrorist? And then people are asking, well, couldn't we have caught these guys before this act happened? Well, you know, you're not going to be able to catch people who do things like the Newtown shooting or this kind, the Boston Marathon bombers, these lone, alienated, angry guys who are operating from motives that are simply not within the normal range of human actions. You know, these guys, this took a level of callousness and a level of anger that's just beyond normal. You're not going to be able to catch people like this.
Yeah, and two things on that. One is that you also had a tremendous amount of chatter, and it hasn't entirely died down, about charging the surviving suspect as an enemy combatant, which it would actually go far beyond even Obama's terrible record of targeting U.S. citizens for assassination abroad. This is targeting a U.S. citizen for being designated an enemy combatant based solely on what he is charged with, which, you know, is exactly the sort of thing that generations of conservatives previously in this country despised Stalin for doing, except that Stalin at least had the courtesy to do show trials. We wouldn't even be doing that.
It's a level of response and a level of repression that goes beyond what is necessary.
And, well, it goes far, far beyond what is necessary. And you know, we have an entire political class of professional bedwetters in this country who appeal to people's fear. And we're seeing that in full flower this past week and a half, particularly when you consider that in the same week last week, you had the far larger level of death and destruction and tragedy going on in West Texas with the fertilizer plant explosion. That, as we talked about last week, was also an act of terrorism. That was far more preventable, and we know exactly what would need to be done in order to prevent it. You know, regulation and enforcement, even of existing laws, let alone additional laws that would force corporate accountability. But that story, because of Boston, disappeared from the news within about 36 hours, and there's been no follow-up talking about how we could prevent future major industrial accidents from happening. And you know that they will, particularly given that kind of climate.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to use my dictatorial powers to jump to international, starting with Iraq.
That's fine. That's you, Jeff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm just trying to find my place here. Yeah. The news this week from Iraq, not very good. And we instead are getting a deluge of publicity around the opening of the Bush Library, which whose allegiance to facts apparently is somewhere close to that of the Creation Museum. You know, talking about Bush's great wisdom and success in invading Iraq, we're still seeing the impacts of that invasion and occupation a decade later. Dozens of people dying each day, Tuesday and Wednesday, in sectarian violence, much of it instigated by the government across Iraq. Once again, Iraq threatening to slide into a fairly vicious sectarian war. And we've got a fairly authoritarian and extremely corrupt central government now, which again is being propped up by the United States. We still have tens of thousands of troops in Iraq that are quote-unquote advisors and not playing combatant roles, but they're participating in, for example, on Wednesday you had Iraqi soldiers opening fire from helicopters on a village in a small town in northern Kurdish Iraq, killing a couple dozen people. And at the same time that similar attacks are going on around the country. This is the kind of chaos that's going on in Iraq. And whatever you want to say about what a murderous thug Saddam Hussein was, and he was, the last 10 years and counting now of experience in Iraq directly brought on by the divisions encouraged by the United States during its occupation makes the time of Saddam Hussein seem like a peaceful and prosperous time in Iraqi history by comparison.
Yeah, and this is widely viewed as our success story in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have to wonder, how are we not creating more terrorists?
Yeah, it's not viewed that way by Iraqis, by the way.
No, or other people from the Middle East or Muslim countries. Speaking of another country where corporate accountability is severely lacking, it was another month and another factory disaster in Bangladesh. Folks have probably heard about the collapse of the Rana Plaza factory in Bangladesh, which has led to over 300 deaths and counting. This is another instance where major corporations like Walmart and Benetton and other companies that manufacture cheap clothing in China and Bangladesh take advantage of low wages and lack of any kind of government regulations that pertain to worker safety in order to make the cheapest clothing and at the lowest cost and provide it to Westerners at extremely low cost. So you know, folks, if you're tired of hearing about disasters in the third world where people are crushed in eight-story buildings that were never permitted, should never have been built beyond the fourth story, you know, if you're tired of hearing about the blood the blood price of your cheap clothing, well, you can do something about it and vote with your dollars, not to buy your clothing at places like The Gap, H&M, Benetton, and Walmart.
And you can make sure that kind of lack of regulation and oversight does not come to the U.S. and those kind of disasters don't become more prevalent in the U.S. as well.
Yeah, because Walmart wouldn't be in Bangladesh if they could pay starvation wages and have no regulations for worker safety here in the United States.
30 seconds, Guatemala.
Yeah, the genocide trial of General Efrén Ríos Montt, who was supported by President Reagan, the U.S. government, put on hold this past week after under heavy pressure from Guatemala's current president, who was himself a member of death squads in the 1980s. It's remarkable that the U.S. government, which was supplied the ammunition and the money and the international political cover that made that genocide possible, and our Nobel Peace Prize laureate president has said nothing about that lack of justice in Guatemala.
Yeah.
Events.
A number of them again this week. Tuesday night, April 30th, 7:30 p.m., there'll be a free screening of the new biographical Angela Davis documentary, Free Angela. That'll be at the AMC South Center 16 in Tukwila. And they're requesting RSVP, and the link for that is on the program notes for this show that we'll be posting later today. Wednesday will be May Day. So from noon to 6 o'clock, the annual May 1 Immigrant Rights March is being sponsored this year by the Washington Dream Act Coalition and is going to focus on immigration reform legislation. Gather at noon at Judkins Park and at 611 20th Avenue South in Seattle. And at 1 o'clock will be a march for the federal building. And then that evening after the Immigrant March, if you want to make a full day of it, there'll be the annual May Day anti-capitalist march and second annual police riot that will be that will be at Seattle Central College Community College South Plaza, where people will be gathering Broadway and Pine on Capitol Hill.
And what time is that again?
6 o'clock.
6 o'clock.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish, Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is at www.eatthestate.org. There were a few stories we didn't get to today because Maria and I haven't been on the show together for a while, so we had a lot to say. But that'll be posted later today at www.eatthestate.org with the calendar of items and links on all the various stories. So check it out. Mm-hmm.